Lady herself, the vocal instrumentalist par excellence, Ella Fitzgerald, with a pianist par excellence, Oscar Peterson, with a live performance of Airmail Special. This was done in 1961 in Canada. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead, and it's the day after the grand 4th of July. And it is Free Your Mind Friday. So let's hear what you've been thinking. And, well, you know, I don't want you to critique necessarily the president's speech, although there are very many interesting things about it. But Not the speech itself, but the whole environment of it is what is important. It's very important. So what are you thinking? What's on your mind? What have you to offer today for us to consider? Your pointed ideas and opinions and information that you think is really important for us to take a look at and examine. That's what happens on Free Your Mind Friday. It's important to share with us because this is how we build community, and I'm all about that. Let's build community through communication and exchange of information, opinions, and ideas. We have Joe Biden. You can see the hurt in Joe. He cannot believe that Ms. Harris has done this to him. He can't get over it. But we'll see how that works out. Ron from Connecticut, you're on the air.
Greetings and salutations.
Thank you.
Two parts to my comments today. I'm going to use an analogy from the Peanuts comics. When you heard the kids talking, they simply spoke. When you heard the parents...
Hold on a second, Ron. For some reason, we're getting feedback. Are you speaking directly into whatever mechanism you use, a phone or a microphone?
Yeah, I've got my Bluetooth speaker right next to my phone. Is this any better?
Well, we'll see.
Okay.
Because, you know, the feedback interferes with us hearing you clearly.
Let me turn off my Bluetooth. I think that's going to improve things.
That's good. Certainly
How
did
about
improve
the, yeah,
things.
Yeah, I think we fixed the problem now. So when you heard grown-ups talking in the late Charles Schulz's comic Peanuts, it was always a wonky sound. So I want to say that the only voice that makes any sense to me is Tulsi Gabbard. And everyone else, including the talking, the hosts and the mediator and the talking heads, I'm going to substitute sounds of flatulation for what you hear coming out of the wonky sounds. That's what's coming out of everybody's mouth. The second part of my comment, if Congressperson Gabbard is anything at all of what she says she is, she's going to need a company of protectors, and I suggest she's going to need at least 300 staff of, I would suggest, veterans, armed forces veterans, to protect her, and even that might not keep the evil ones who are seething and just waiting for the opportunity to take her out. If she gains
what makes Gabbard so different to the point of being threatening, in your view?
She is hands above all the other candidates, including Sanders, who's still a war person. What makes her is her commitment to straighten things out, to stop the evil, powerful children from genociding with all their toys, all their military toys. She's got a pretty good platform, and she probably is Trump's biggest threat. I have a problem with her staying in the party. I think she should go independent, but even the independent part, the third party, can and probably will get just as corrupted as the Republicans and Democrats. So I'm not sure if third party is the answer, but, you know, she should split off, have nothing to do with Sanders. He's a complete and utter phony. And I think so are all the others. And so she's willing to do it the correct way. She wants to go, you know, she wants, and she will. She'll easily take the nomination for the Democratic candidate for the presidency. But I think they're going to take her out as soon as they can. If she's really authentic, they're going to try to kill her. And she needs all the protection she can get. I pray for her daily, as I do for you, Beatrice.
Well, thank you. I could use it. But, you know, I'm trying to get to the nut of the issue. You're saying she's authentic. You're saying that she's saying things that even the Democratic Party is not going to be saying as its official position. But no, then said. Why is she there still?
They're just doing a wait and see. I'm sure that in their arrogance, they feel they can take her out anytime they want. They probably already planned it. They probably already planned the date, as they planned the date that they would assassinate the great Martin Luther King.
But aren't you being
Riverside Church?
Aren't you being a bit? What should I say? Aren't you being a bit extreme in your view?
I was going to say realistic. I thought you would say.
Huh?
Extreme in my view. She is a greater threat than JFK was to the CIA, the deep state, the permanent state called, and they're not all the same. I understand there are subtle differences, but she's the biggest threat to the machine since JFK. And I'm gonna do my wait and see, as are the evil ones. We're just waiting to see what kind of traction she gains, and she's gaining a lot. I mean, there's so many people talking about her now because they tried to black her out at the beginning. It was useless. So if she is what she claims to be, then she's a great hope for the nation. But I strongly, you know, you think I'm being extreme? I mean,
you're forecasting her assassination, you know, if this continues and...
She shouldn't even trust her Secret Service. She should trust close friends who happen to be veterans, trained in combat and willing to dedicate themselves to her protection. No, I'm not being extreme. Look at what's already happened. Anyone important gets taken out duly. And as I said,
they planned the date a year from
his Riverside Church speech. I'm sorry.
And see why, in your view, she's such a threat to the status quo Democratic Party. Thanks so much for starting us off today. Harvey from Berkeley, you're on the air. By the way, the number is 888-874-4888. Harvey, you're on the air.
Hello, fantastic Utrice.
Hey, fantastic Harvey.
How are you today? Well,
how
I'd like to talk about I'd like to talk about the weather, and in places like India and Pakistan, the weather has been terrible. It's been, you know, I think Pakistan experienced 123 degrees. In France, there's been heat reports of 113 degrees Fahrenheit, and parts of India, they say, are too hot to for humans to live. And the European satellite agency announced that June was the hottest month ever recorded on Earth. And at the same time, since taking office in 2017, President Trump has worked to promote the coal, oil, and gas industry, as well as roll back environmental rules designed to reduce carbon emissions that are heating up our planet, accelerating the melting of the world's glaciers and polar caps, which are leading to sea rise that will inundate our coasts and inland cities. New York has already experienced storm surges that flooded parts of Lower Manhattan, as well as the subway tunnels. And cities like New Orleans, as well as states that you live in, Florida, are more than vulnerable to sea rise. Meanwhile, President Trump wants to build a wall, not a sea wall, to protect our country's coastal areas and cities from ocean rise. He wants to use our tax dollars, or billions of our tax dollars, to build a wall across a desert, the American-Mexican border. And if our coastal cities get flooded, there'll be sewage backups into the streets. Our toilets won't work. Freshwater supplies will be compromised. Transportation systems will grind to a halt. And that will be we will suffer under the Trump administration's lack of leadership in protecting us, because he and his administration, as I've repeated in the past, are a wholly owned subsidiary of the fossil fuel industry. So it's upon us to fortify our coastal cities and work to preserve our country, because the current administration won't do it. And I believe one thing that we can do is, of course, put solar panels on our rooftops and buy electric cars, plug them into our solar electric rooftops, and divest from the fossil fuel industries, because there's no profit in a burnt out planet, and we have to take action now rather than wait till later if we want to see our cities survive and we'll function and flourish. Our great nation will function okay and get through this climate destabilization that the current administration is accelerating.
Well, I think in fact, in Miami right now, they're dealing with still the after effects of Hurricane Maria, and the water levels have risen to such a degree that they haven't gone down. This is a major problem. The real estate industry in South Florida is at its wit's end trying to figure out how do they get the government to respond appropriately to this problem. And of course, the reason I'm pointing to them is that they represent the higher end. So you could imagine what's happening at the lower end of the real estate chain. No response really at all. People are still trying to get out from under the water, and every time the tide rises, so does a calamity of trying to figure out where do you direct the water where there's no place to direct the water. So it is a very real problem. The coastal areas are a real problem. Even in New York, still trying to deal with the after effects of the hurricane. So the issue, I think, is that the government is taking a position so far that it is so enormous an issue that they can't even begin to put their heads around how much money it will cost to abate the problem. So they don't raise it. They pretend it doesn't exist, because to raise it is to now begin a major battle over tax dollars that should abate this problem. What do you think about that?
I think you're absolutely right, and one of the problems, especially in places like Florida, is as the sea rises, you'll get saltwater inundation into the freshwater aquifers, which means that the water that comes from the deep wells will turn salty and undrinkable. It's really a problem that we have to face now. I know we're kept at each other's throats by the popular media, but we really have to get together on this one, especially, they keep on saying that, I keep reading articles that saying the polar caps are melting faster than our computer models have predicted. Well, it's just going to get faster and faster now. And so this is above and beyond all our personal feelings about each other, and we have to save the world, literally save the world, for us, our children, and future generations. And securing our coastal cities is a very first good step, as well as stepping away from fossil fuels towards renewable energy.
Thanks, Harvey, for your call. Always something to think about when you are on the air. Thank you so much. Mitch from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yeah, hello, Latrice.
Hello.
Thanks for taking my call. I read this article not so long ago about the black maternity rate. Infant maternity rate is higher amongst African-American women than any other ethnic group. And I live in Brooklyn, and the hospitals that they identified that had the most death rates were in our communities. Brookdale, Wyckoff, and Kings County. And as I got into companies with some of the politicians, I pointed this out to them, and nobody seems to be concerned about it. Yeah, we'll talk about it, we'll put it to a committee, but I think it's something that should be investigated. You know, why is the death rates amongst our people higher than any third world country?
So, could you advance a theory about that?
Well, you know, it could be a lot of. I couldn't. You know, is it threat, stress? Is it the environment? Is it the foods that we're eating? It could be a lot of things, you know, but, you know, it's something that I was reading somewhere where the governor of New Jersey has put together a committee to try and go into this and see why it's happening, because apparently he's aware of it.
Well, but, in fact, they have been aware of it for decades. And it is one aspect. It is not to be seen in isolation. It is part of a range of maladies and problems that these distressed communities are experiencing. And you could call it quality of life. The quality of life in these communities is poor. And the powers that be for all these decades haven't seen the need to really deal with improving the quality of life in poor districts. The level of poverty, we don't think of it as poverty because, of course, this is the United States of America. How could you have poverty here?
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're living in the big city. How could you have poverty there? But in fact, you look at the full range of things that would impact a person's life from day to day, violence, poor food, housing, poor housing, all these things come together. Unemployment, you would never consider unemployment or poor food to be a factor in infant mortality, but it is. So there has been an unwillingness to take a comprehensive view of how poverty, which is at the root of it all, how poverty affects everything, a whole string of things when it comes to quality of life. If you look at the foods that people have access to, you see the clear need for education and to tackle that. What is the nutritional value of a child's meal every day? What are you feeding? And then they will discourage things like breastfeeding and encourage the use of these baby foods like Enfamil and other things that you would give a baby out of a can, because that is far more lucrative than having or teaching women the value of breastfeeding. In every poor country, it's the same dynamic. You discourage breastfeeding, you encourage dependency on prepared foods from a can. In every single poor country all over the world. And you see that there is, this is low on the list of priorities of reorganizing our thinking about poverty and eradicating poverty. It's very important to have poverty, to encourage it. So that other sectors will make a lot of money. How is it that you call these hospitals, Wyckoff, which were the other ones that you called? You could name any number of hospitals in poor communities, and they're not getting people any better, because that's not what they're there for. They provide a lot of employment for people who otherwise would be struggling to compete for jobs in the open market. But it doesn't mean they're getting good care.
Right.
You know, so the problem that we need to tackle here, it seems to me, is a question of poverty and all the contributing factors to it. Because what you're pointing out is perhaps one of the most obvious consequences of poverty in our communities, where you have low birth weight babies, you have babies, infant mortality is high, you have undernourished children. It's all stemming from the same thing, and they won't tackle it from that perspective because there's so much money to be made by ignoring all of that.
Well, as I look at it, like I was born in West Virginia, and we didn't have a whole lot, but what we had, we cherished and we made the best of it. But we heard nothing of babies dying at birth, and we had midwives down there, most of the midwives. Most of the babies in that area were born at home. Uh-huh. And we didn't have this, I don't think, we didn't have, there was no knowledge of it, of a baby dying at birth or a mother having a miscarriage. And although, like I said, probably, we didn't have that much. but that wasn't the circumstances there. I didn't see it.
So as you think, as you raise the issue, and you think a little bit about your experience as a child yourself growing up and over the years, and now as an adult in a different locality that is supposed to be so much more advanced, could you think of something or some issue or some cause that might be contributing to what you are pointing out today as an aberration?
No, I couldn't. You know, like, I at this point, I couldn't, because, like I said, we didn't have the best. We most of our food was out of the garden, and people...
Hello?
They didn't buy canned... Hello? And they didn't buy canned food.
No, I'm saying you were doing organic farming without, you know, making... It was natural. Your food came from your garden.
And all the women at the end, in the fall of the year, they get together and they can their foods and they put it in the cellar. And we'd eat canned food. We'd eat food that they had put in jars and canned themselves. And we'd eat that. We didn't eat out of the supermarket. We didn't eat out of cans that much.
Mm-hmm.
But I find that, you know... But
that
it's,
is a,
it's something
a big help.
That should be looked into,
help.
You know.
Well, most people, as you know, in New York City don't eat out of their gardens because they don't have gardens.
Right, yeah.
And there are different gradations of food depending on the community that you live in.
Right, yeah, that's true.
So the food that you would get on the Upper West Side at any typical supermarket, the quality is very different from the food that you would get at a local grocery store in an impoverished area in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Well,
and then you have the issue of children. It's a whole industry. It's an industry. And people are encouraged, especially poor people, are encouraged, they're switched away from natural ways of caring for children, breastfeeding being one of them. And the industry has packaged everything for babies born in Bushwick and in Bedford-Stuyvesant and in the South Bronx and so forth. They target these communities. And the people are encouraged to see this as a convenience, takes away so much hassle of parenting. You know, you open up a can of Enfamil and great, your baby's had a meal. But when you look at the contents and you look at what children are being fed from infancy straight through. We, in these communities, poor communities, are the dumping ground for a lot of things that are harmful, but make money, tremendous amount of money, and in fact are more expensive in the long run than taking care to eat better foods, better quality foods, and so forth. They're not interested in that. But you raise a very good point, Mitch, and this is, it escapes us all the time. We don't think of it as a problem, but when you read, you look at the correlation between poor food, poor quality food, that people are paying a lot for or being subsidized at a higher price than regular food, you see the problem. It is part of the factors, a range of factors that in the end contribute to a shortened life,
yeah,
quality of life, you know, goes down.
Yeah. But every time I get one, each time I get one of these politicians in his ear, borough presidents on down, I bring this up to him. So maybe eventually something they could be, make it be known, do some type of study. I mean, when they had this opioid thing going on, people were dying and that, they did something real quick about it. Put billions of dollars into it right away. You know, studies,
and
all kinds of studies to find this out. But
why do you think that they hurried to get this problem solved so quickly?
Well,
putting billions of dollars into it.
Well, the money, they're dealing with other types of people, I would say.
Okay, that's the answer. A population different from the population they didn't care about in the beginning was being affected. And therefore it constituted a problem, and a problem that they had to deal with quickly, to intervene, to prevent unnecessary deaths. That's the answer. It was the answer when heroin became an issue. It was the answer when any kind of drug or any kind of bad habit that leads to death, they could deal with the deaths of people of color, no problem. But when whites start suffering inordinately from these issues, then they become problems that have to be resolved. So they'll throw a lot of money at it, and they will suddenly develop all these different strategies to cut down the incidence of death. But in black communities and poor communities, this is the norm. They don't care whether children are dying. You know, as they would be able to point to a program that says, look how much money we giving so that they can buy the right foods. And what are the right foods? They're all canned foods. They're all mass-produced foods that have nothing to offer in the way of nutrition and to improve a quality of life. They don't see it as a holistic problem about the stresses that people are living with, the violence people are living with, the lack of housing, the lack of gainful employment. All these are the reasons that you have certain populations suffering inordinately from problems that you think, well, this is easy to solve. But they become a market. They become the answer to a lot of problems that in the larger society they'd like to solve. Where do you put all these marginally performing doctors? Where do you find them? In our communities. Where do you find all these problems that we shouldn't have to cope with, but in fact every day they account for distress and loss of life in our communities?
Right.
So you raise an excellent point, but the thing is, I think we have to get active about it, and we have to advocate for our distressed communities, not just the mothers and the children, but everybody in our communities. Everybody is suffering inordinately. And it has, on the bottom line, a traumatic impact on the quality of life and life itself.
So maybe one day, you know, you could have people on there talking about this thing, and we can get to these politicians and the black caucus, you know, make these things issues that affect us, you know. It ain't just the Russians. It's what's going on in our community, because that's all they're talking about is the Russians.
But that's what I meant. I've talked about reclaiming community. We are not reclaiming our communities. We don't. We are waiting for somebody to solve this problem. We are not ourselves doing the work.
Right.
Even though we know how necessary it is. So that is where we start. We start not by pointing at the politicians. We start by making a commitment to reclaim our communities, as many aspects as we determine are necessary for a well-functioning community. That's what we have to do. And you can't get more important than babies.
Yes, ma'am.
So somebody has to step forward and begin an advocacy program that points this out, because technically, and this may shock you, communities like yours in Brooklyn are on the same level as communities that the United Nations cites globally as communities in distress. Would you believe that?
Yeah, I would believe it, yes.
Well, that means that there is an urgency, a major problem. When your neighborhood is at the same level as neighborhoods that have, communities that have experienced war and drought and famine and so forth, when your community is on par with that, it means you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And people have to react accordingly. They do. Thank you, Mitch, for your very, very poignant call today. David from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Yes. Good afternoon, Yatrice.
Hello.
It's such a good program today. There's so many areas that I'd like to talk on. I don't know where to start.
Let's just start.
All right. Okay. I'm going to start with Harvey. And Harvey talked about climate change and the sea level rise in certain areas, especially coastal areas. I have some strong feeling about that. And one of my feelings is that people should not feel entitled to build homes right on the beachfront or in areas that are dangerous in terms of sea level rise, and expect the government to ensure their place. I think that people have to be much more careful about where they construct homes and live. There are certain places that shouldn't be inhabited by the population, especially around the seashore. There may, and South Florida is certainly one of them. And it's extremely, I feel, dangerous to live in those places. And I don't want the taxpayers of this country to be subsidizing people living in extremely dangerous places.
Do you not see how this happened?
Well,
when these places are predominantly white.
Yes.
And upper class, if you will. They're not working class communities.
Yeah.
But when the political structure says, because of the demand of the real estate industry, we need the government to shore up this coastline area so that it will be attractive to people with money to live on and by the sea. And so they find money from wherever they can take it, and they reinforce, or at least they make it appear that they've reinforced these coastlines to the point where they're safe for habitation. You can build. And then you build, you're not building a $2 house. You're building in the upper echelons because now you're a new tax base. And yes. they get the response from government that they need. Lots of money poured into securing the shoreline.
Plus
that should have gone to other things.
And as I see it, this is not in the interest of the average taxpayer in this country. We shouldn't be subsidizing people who live in the Hamptons, right on the water's edge, with our tax money for insurance, government insurance, for that type of facility that they want in that area. So that now not only applies to up here in New York and the Hamptons and Florida and certain places on the West Coast, but all over. We have to be much more mindful of where we let people live close to the water. So I think that's a very important item. Also, there's so many things that have been brought up today that are really interesting. In terms of the question you dealt with previously about the medical condition, in a country such as this, a capitalist country where the ruling class is in full control, to have the idea that they, those in control, really care about the masses of people is ludicrous, because they care about one thing, and that's profits on themselves. So what they care about, the people at the bottom of this totem pole, is that these people don't rebel. And so we're going to do just enough to keep a rebellion from happening. So, you know, they don't care about the health and things that they should care about, infant mortality and that sort of thing. And all you have to do, if you want to see what I'm talking about, is take a ride on one of the buses over here in Brooklyn and the areas where many people of color live, and observe all the very sick people that are on that bus. Whereas you compare it to when you go over to Manhattan, to you talk about the Upper West Side or the Upper East Side, and you ride the bus over there, and you'll see a much different type of passenger on the bus, and mostly healthy-looking people on that bus. So this is the nature of the system that we live in. Now, the third thing I want to talk about is all this talk about the debates, and especially in the community of color, people don't have anywhere to go. They're not going to join with the Republicans now. And so regardless of what the Democrats put up there, many people feel that they don't have a choice. But that has to change. That has to change. You cannot go and throw your vote away like that. As far as I'm concerned, you need to think of three particular areas. First of all, for each candidate that you're looking at of this gang of crooks, that mostly crooks that are running for president, for example, you need to look at, number one, what they say they are for, and look at it carefully. That's the first thing. Then the next thing you have to do is see who is supporting them. Where are they getting the money? Where are those ducats coming from? The corporate people or whoever. And keep that in mind. And the third thing you have to do is look at their past record, what they have done in the past, and what they have stood for in the past. And we have to do those three things. And if those things don't match up with what is good for you and your community, you need not to participate in voting for any one of those people in that Democratic lineup that is presented for you. It's not enough to say, well, I have to vote for them because I don't like Trump. No, that's no reason to just vote for somebody because you don't like Trump. So you need to do something else or not participate in this charade that's supposed to be a Democratic election. The people on that Democratic group, in that Democratic group of candidates, most of them have been well vetted class. And we need to look at that and take that in consideration before we make a decision for voting for someone just because you don't like Trump.
Amen. That's all I have to say. Amen to what you have offered us today, David. Thank you so much. Patricia from New York, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Utrice, and good afternoon to the PRN family. Something interesting has happened here in New York. The race for the Queens District Attorney's Office that was vacated by Michael Brown, who passed away earlier this year, was won by, at least we thought, Tiffany Caban, who was supported by Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, and Ocasio-Cortez. But it seems as now that the absentee ballots are being counted, it looks as though Melinda Katz, who was the Democratic Party candidate, may actually survive after all. They will probably have to do a recount. But even if Tiffany Caban does not win, the message that I have is that, in fact, in that Queens area, they are literally doing the work, because Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez unseated David Crowley last year, who has for people who don't know, was chair of the Queens Democratic County Committee and had been in that position for over two decades. And even if Tiffany Caban does not win, the fact that she would have come so close to unseating again the party candidate who's now Melinda Katz, who at present is the Queens County, the Queensborough president, and of course now that Joe Crowley was unseated, Gregory Meeks is now the Queens Democratic Party chair. They are doing the work. And so my question to black folks is, why are we not doing the work? When you talk about maternal and infant mortality, as I think most people know, I'm a midwife, and that's something that we have actually been looking at for years. What is it about black women that causes them to have the high maternal mortality rates that they do? And, you know, again, it comes down to racism and the distribution of resources. So when you look at, first of all of these hospitals, not just here in New York, but across the country, are becoming monopolies, so that you have the larger institutions gobbling up the smaller hospitals. And when you look at the resources that are being funneled into these institutions, the institutions that need it the most are the ones that get the least. And so when you talk about, you know, affordable housing, because affordable housing is the fulcrum for everything else that happens. If you don't have affordable housing, you live in segregated communities. You get segregated schools. You get the worst performing schools. You get kids who don't get out of middle school, much less high schools. Those are the kids who never have an opportunity to get the good jobs. And it just goes on and on and on. So when you look at healthcare just mirrors the fact that these communities are already the ones that don't get the resources that they need. Because I can tell you, we've done the research. And when you compare black women to poor white women, black women with college education, their outcomes are less than white women, poor white women with a high school diploma. A black woman who never smoked a day in her life, her outcome is less than a white woman who smoked throughout her entire pregnancy. A black woman who never used drugs does worse than a white woman who used drugs her entire pregnancy. So it's not, it doesn't have anything to do with, number one, we have learned that higher education doesn't protect black women. Not even social class protects black women. Nothing protects black women. You know, Malcolm said black women are the most disrespected and unprotected people in America. The rules of civility don't apply to black women. So when we talk about maternal mortality, keep in mind that it has nothing to do with the fact that these folks don't know. They know. We've been talking about it for years. And the statistics have been done, the research has been done, but if you're not going to deal with racism and the foundations and the distribution of resources, there's nothing else to talk about.
Okay. And we've known this for a long, long time. And it hasn't motivated the political representation or even the civic representation in these communities to do something about it and to make it a major issue, you know.
I think black people are just beaten down. We're just beaten down. The immigrant community is galvanized and we are just beaten down.
Wow. Do you see any hope at all?
I have to have hope. I have to have hope. Because when I leave this earth, I have children and grandchildren that have to keep on going, and they have to survive. So I have to have hope. And, you know, I do see a generational shift. So those older, racist, white folks that are supporting Trump, you know, they're getting ready to meet their maker. They're getting ready to meet their transition. And what's coming up behind them are more, you know, woke and aware people. So I have to have hope. But for black folks, if we don't wake up, I know we're beaten down, but we have somehow got to dig deep and find out what we are made of, and we got to start resisting. Because if you look at the immigrant community, and again, the whole example of Ocasio-Cortez and Tiffany Caban, that Queens Democratic machine is heavy. They shouldn't be doing what they're doing. So the question is, why are they having success and we're not?
I have a sneaky suspicion that some conversion is going on. People who used to be ostracized because they meet a very important criterion for whiteness in this country. There's a gray area emerging here where people who used to be ostracized are being accepted because they are acceptably white.
Yes.
That is going on. Thanks, Patricia, for your commentary today. I really think it was instructive. If people are listening, now, this is not an ordinary person. This is a person speaking from a position of experience and authority. And we need to respect that and give credence to what she has said. Thank you so much for calling.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of our program today. The weekend comes up, and it's always a good idea over the weekend if you could find some time to reassess things and surround yourselves with people who can help you, you know, in that process of reassessing things. And hopefully there would also be people who bring positive dimension to your life. This is important. If people don't offer you anything positive in your life, dump them and move on. We'll see each other on Monday, and have yourselves a great weekend. Bye-bye. Brooding, doody, brooding, doody, 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 doody,
Brooding duty, 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 brooding duty.